It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Heather Like has been on the job as the director of athletics at the University of Pittsburgh just 17 months, but has definitely made an imprint on the program, promoting, hiring coaches, building community beyond the university, and staying away from social media. And yes, we will talk about that big game, the renewed rivalry, coming up Saturday night at Heinz Field. Heather Like, welcome to the confluence.
Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Before coming to Pitt, AD at Eastern Michigan, assistant athletic director at Ohio State for, I believe, about 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
How did those experiences help formulate what you wanted to do here at the University of Pittsburgh?
You know, having the opportunity to be at a place like Ohio State, you got a real understanding of what excellence looks like across the board. They happen to have 36 sports, and you know, just you compete at the highest level across the board. And we did that at Eastern Michigan as well. And you know, just when you have, we have 19 teams at the University of Pittsburgh, and my philosophy about comprehensive excellence, about every team going and competing for ACC and national championships was, you know, was learned and is certainly modeled after the programs that I've been fortunate to be a part of.
Right. ACC, of course, the Atlantic Coast Conference that the university has been in for several years now. So there are some big, let's say, personalities in the high dollar sports. What are the challenges as an athletic director in managing these big personalities?
You know, I look at managing head coaches, you know, all the same. I mean, they are absolute head coaches. They have great expectations. It's all about building relationships and them knowing that ultimately we're going to do everything we can within the rules, with great integrity, to provide them with the tools and resources necessary for them to have success. You know, we want our coaches and student athletes to achieve at the highest level, certainly athletically, but academically and personally and socially in other ways. So it's about a relationship, you know, and you have to have great communication and you have to make time to meet and spend time with one another. And that's certainly the way I approach both my relationship with Coach Narduzzi and Coach Capel.
Pitt specifically has faced its share of challenges before you were hired. School had like more than a dozen coaches, football coaches, ADs around the last decade alone. So what does it mean to you to institute stability in the overall athletics program?
Yeah, you must have read my my message to our all-staff meeting coming up. So our very first all-staff meeting in another week, the theme is going to be about not just about teamwork, but about unity, stability, and continuity. We've had a lot of transition over the time, even since I've been here. There's been a number of key transitions and important things that had to happen and some, you know, that just did happen. And our team is now together. And they're, you know, dynamic. I'd put them up against anybody in the country. And our focus moving forward this coming year is about stability. It's about continuity and how we build upon everything that we're doing right now and make it better in year two.
Has fundraising followed that stability?
You know, I think that there's been a very loyal support of donors to the University of Pittsburgh. We're fortunate. We're grateful for the level of support that we get from a lot of donors who've given for a long time, regardless of transitions. I will say that our opportunity is to build the network of donors that are out there and build the relationships for people that haven't been touched, that haven't been back connected. And it's our chance to connect them. And obviously, I think through the world of athletics, it's a language that many of us all speak. It's a way to connect. It's a chance to bring people back to campus and experience those memories that they might have had as students or as student athletes.
As the first woman as Pitt's athletic director, you're at the helm of collegiate sports. What does it mean to you personally? Do you feel a certain obligation, pressure to be an example for all athletes, including women athletes, and also students maybe studying sports management across the city?
Mm-hmm. I get this question sometimes. I don't know that it's any different for me as a female versus a male. I mean, I think coaches all treat me the same. I look at student athletes all the same. I mean, the reality is they're all trying to do the best job that they can. And I have profound respect because I was a former student athlete. So I can appreciate many years ago, but I can appreciate the expectations that are placed upon them and the demands. as a female, you know, I have great role models out there, not a ton of them, but there are women that I know had it harder than me. And you do feel a responsibility to help develop and maybe inspire young people to never put limits on what you're capable of, and never put a ceiling out there for yourself. You can do whatever you know you're passionate about and, you know, work hard at.
But the students studying sports management, they're getting more role models like yourself, and there are slowly getting to be more women ADs across college sports.
Yeah, no question. I mean, the number has grown. Women leaders in college sports is a very active, productive organization that I'm on their board. And yeah, there's no question we're making headway. We have a long ways to go still. But it's, you know, I attribute it to, you know, a chancellor like Chancellor Gallagher, who, you know, I report to, and him having confidence and faith in my ability to do that, regardless of being a male or a female.
Yeah. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, you mentioned being a student athlete, softball at the University of Michigan, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right, what position?
First base. I'm left-handed.
Okay. Heather Like is our guest. She's the athletic director at the University of Pittsburgh. 2 weeks ago, Ohio State University announced that head football coach Urban Meyer would be suspended for the first three games of the season following an investigation into his handling of domestic abuse allegations against a former assistant coach. The athletic director of Ohio State, Gene Smith, was also suspended without pay between August 31st and September 16th. There were several allegations through the years of domestic violence by Zach Smith against Courtney Smith while they were married and after they divorced. Ohio State is one of your former schools. What do you take from this particular case? How can you use that to strengthen your policies regarding domestic violence specifically and Title IX compliance?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think all of these situations are highly complex. And, you know, it's difficult because no one really has all the facts. But what we can do with the information that we do know and have is, there's no question, we call them lessons learned. You know, we can have a lessons learned session with our head coaches. We can talk to our staff more, very intently, very specifically, and talk about this case, if you will, as a lesson to be learned in how we manage and get better every day. You know, you can't question, and you have no idea what people should or shouldn't have done at other places. But I think in our own world, we can take those lessons and just do the best we can to put the information and be very transparent about our communication and our expectations in regards to these issues.
When your coaches go out and recruit young high school athletes to come to the University of Pittsburgh, I'm sure they're telling parents, look, we're going to take care of your kids. Mm-hmm. We're going to get them a good education. We'll help develop them to the best of their abilities, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to keep them safe. Mm-hmm. After the death of a University of Maryland freshman football player, a lineman, following drills, he seized and he died 2 weeks after that. Do you go back and double check and triple check on the safety precautions that your sports teams put into place?
Yeah, there is, you know, no question that the most important thing that I think an athletic director does is hire head coaches. You know, they directly impact the lives of other people's kids every day. As an athletic director, I sort of have an indirect impact, and our head coaches have a direct impact on their experience and their lives. So, you know, I feel incredibly grateful for the head coaches that we have at the University of Pittsburgh. I'm confident in who they are as people and why they coach. And so, you know, there's no question it gives us a chance to talk about the importance of the young people that they impact every day. Our sports medicine team and our partnership with UPMC is extraordinary. It's a difference maker in our operation. And, you know, it gives us a chance, again, to collaborate with them, talk about these issues, talk about how we would manage similar situations and do a, you know, obviously a good job at that.
All right, we have just a couple minutes left. We have to talk about it. The big rivalry, Pitt hosts Penn State Saturday evening at Heinz Field next September. Mm-hmm. It'll be the last one, hopefully just for a while. Why is this rivalry at least ending now?
Well, It's ending, you know, I wouldn't say it's really ending. I mean, let's just say,
pausing.
You know, it's pausing. But, you know, we've played football for 129 years at Pitt, and, you know, 29 of those, I think we've played everything, every time, but except maybe 29 or 30 years against Penn State. So it's a big, big deal to us. We want to do it for the state, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We think it's an incredibly credible rivalry. We have great respect for Penn State, and we think it's just a terrific game and experience for all of our fans and alumni and the players themselves and the coaches. That you think about the quality of players that have played in that game over the years. I mean, there's just some extraordinary Heisman Trophy winners, NFL Hall of Famers, all that sort of thing. So we'd love it to continue, and we hope it will down the road.
It could have resumed in 2026.
Yes.
But?
They did not want it to resume at that time.
Are you still pursuing, or are you waiting? It's time for you to pursue us now.
No, we've scheduled on. I mean, you know, you get to a point where you have to put an ultimatum in and you say, like, let's do this deal, or we have to move in a different direction because everybody's starting to schedule. So we'll be doing a home-and-home series with Wisconsin.
Okay, a very tough Big Ten team, to be to be honest, as well. So James Franklin, head coach of Penn State, very briefly, basically said, well, you know, we don't want to lose to Pitt or take the chances because a loss 2 years ago knocked them out of the chance for the Final Four of college football. So they're afraid of Pitt?
You know, I'm not going to speak to that. But
leave the trash talking to
yes,
the players.
Yes, yes. But, you know, we have great respect, and we'd love to play them whenever they're available.
All right. Heather Like is the director of athletics at the University of Pittsburgh. Heather, good luck Saturday night, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you, and thanks, everyone. Hail to Pitt.
I'm Megan Harris. Still ahead on The Confluence, voices and stories from Pittsburgh's past. We introduce you to the providers who operated before and after Roe v. Wade, the landmark Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion. And how the city became a mecca, not just for steel, but for the salt industry as well. Plus, a conversation on how our modern city can embrace its jazz roots. See and hear more from our program online at WESA.FM and find us wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Pittsburgh Pirates field the first all-black lineup in Major League Baseball in 1971. Team greats, including Roberto Clemente, Doc Ellis, and Willie Stargell, were among the nine picked to play against the Philadelphia Phillies. Broadcasters at the game at Three Rivers Stadium didn't bring a lot of attention to the groundbreaking lineup at the time. Many of those same players would go on in a month to beat the Baltimore Orioles and win the World Series. Clemente and Stargell have since been inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac for September 5th, 2018.
It's the confluence where the news comes together. Steel mills and coal mines are part of Pittsburgh's rich industrial history. But as 90.5 WESA's Amy Sisk reports for our Good Question series, the region was once a hub for another industry.
Before refrigerators, salt kept meat fresh. It was expensive for Pittsburgh's earliest settlers. It arrived by boat from England, and horses hauled it across the Appalachians. That leg of the trip took 20 days and led to a steep markup in price. This all changed in the early 1800s, and it sparked the curiosity of Good Question listener Charlie Jones. He's a geology lecturer at the University of Pittsburgh.
Well, I read somewhere that the first industrial use of coal in Pittsburgh was to boil salt water from springs to get salt. Where were these springs? Are there any still flowing?
To answer this question, I had to leave Pittsburgh and head 40 miles east to this spot along the Conemaugh River in Indiana County.
Looks like there's a sign up here. It says West Penn Trail at Watson Mine.
This is where a coal mine opened in 1813 to supply fuel to boil brine for the first salt works in western Pennsylvania. But all I could see were trees and a grassy field. So I met up with a local history buff in back of the nearby historical society.
My name's Jack McGuire. I was born and raised here in Salzburg, Pennsylvania.
Salzburg, named for the industry that took off here. McGuire says animals helped lead humans to salt. Deer often congregated around a natural salt lick.
It's just a little crack in the surface of the rock strata
With salty water, the brine trickling out, a resident named Mrs. Deemer realized one of these salty springs was on her land. Her discovery prompted her neighbor to try to produce salt on a big scale. To do that, William Johnston needed to drill into the source of the brine several hundred feet deep. Johnston used a spring pole drill, like the replica McGuire built near the river.
Is that it?
Yes.
McGuire shows me several wooden poles sticking up out of the ground to help support an iron chisel. It pounded the ground over and over again, with momentum generated by the driller's own body weight.
Probably like a two-man, three-man operation.
Each well took up to 10 months to complete. Once the driller hit the watery brine in the rock below, he switched into production mode and started extracting the liquid. That's where the coal came in. Crews burned it to boil the salty water in big cauldron kettles. McGuire points one out on display.
Salt crystals would form, and they'd be scooped out and put in an area to be dried.
By 1830, the valley was the third largest salt producer in the country. Salt works popped up all over southwestern Pennsylvania. This history is chronicled in Salt and the Conemaugh Valley. It's a massive book written by Bill DeZombach, who passed away in 2015. Here's his son.
It's exhaustive.
Dave DeZombach is a civil and environmental engineering professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
That's the way Dad was, a very thorough person, a lot of detail. And, it's probably more of a reference book than a take-it-to-the-beach book.
Bill DeZombach researched the subject for years after retiring from the chemistry department at St. Vincent College in Latrobe. He describes a number of wells in Pittsburgh. One driller struck brine along the Monongahela, and the water reportedly gushed out of the ground, shooting 30 feet in the air. I kept coming across references to wells where the 9 Mile Run flows into the Mon, so I went exploring along the confluence in the East End. There's a lot of rocks, wooden boards, looks like there's an old dock. I couldn't find any sign of the old industry. And I stopped short of taking a sip of the water to see if it tasted salty. Although I have yet to find a salt spring, DeZombach lists over 300 salt makers who set up shop before an oversupply sent profits plummeting. I imagine many of these sites are overgrown or covered by roads and buildings. But some of the springs may still be flowing, known only to the deer that roam nearby, licking up the salt. Amy Sisk, 90.5 WESA News.
Submit your own good question at WESA.FM. It's the confluence where the news comes together. Before Roe v. Wade made abortion legal across the U.S., including Pennsylvania, some members of the Pittsburgh medical community found a legal loophole to provide safe abortions. 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins reports that caused conflict from the emergency room to the courtroom.
The emergency room at McGee Women's Hospital was a very different place 40 years ago. Charlene Bailey's first day of work at McGee was January 5, 1970. She was a nursing assistant in the emergency department, where staff cared for women who had miscarriages or pregnancy complications.
We also commonly had patients that had undergone illegal abortions and were bleeding, in pain, high fever, sick people.
Bailey says women who had botched procedures were afraid of getting in trouble and often waited a long time before they came to the hospital. Many wouldn't even tell doctors what they had done.
Instruments, and I use that term loosely because things like knitting needles, hangers, when you have a spray bottle and there's a little tube that goes down to the bottom of the bottle, things like that.
The goal was to insert these instruments into the uterus, but people who weren't properly trained could accidentally perforate the uterus or bowel. That's how they ended up at McGee with Charlene Bailey. She took their vital signs and filled out their forms. And she wasn't the only one asking patients questions.
The police could be called. Detectives would come in. They'd just hammer these patients with questions. They really wanted to know who did it. Who did this abortion?
All of this happened because abortion was illegal in Pennsylvania. The provision that said so was just a few lines in a 1939 statute. My editor Chris Potter and I went to the Allegheny County Law Library to find it.
And here we go. Ooh. This is it. There you go. Section 718, abortion. Whoever, with intent to procure the miscarriage of any woman, unlawfully administers to her any poison, drug, or substance, or unlawfully uses any instrument or other means with the like intent, is guilty of a felony. And upon
the statute said that abortions obtained unlawfully were illegal, but never defined what unlawful meant. So in 1968, doctors at McGee and West Penn decided that abortions were lawful if continuing the pregnancy would negatively affect the mental health of the mother. Doctors would conduct a physical and psychological evaluation. Then, if her case got the okay, she could get an abortion either from a private physician or at the hospital. Retired Dr. Robert Thompson worked at McGee for over 45 years. He was a resident there after Roe was decided and was familiar with the process.
And this was just mostly to cover your tracks. You know, if you wrote it down in a normal medical manner, it passed.
Thompson says that over half the doctors in the department performed the procedure.
It was a more libertarian attitude. It's like, you do what you do. I don't want to do this. You don't want to do it? That's fine.
But there was significant pushback. McGee doctors who were against abortion filed lawsuits on behalf of unborn children. There were opponents outside the hospital, too. Robert Dugan was the district attorney in the lead-up to the Roe decision. He tried to charge doctors with conspiracy to commit an abortion, according to old newspaper clippings. Dugan tried to obtain patient records from McGee to use as evidence in a case from 1970. Then, three women who had had abortions there filed an injunction to prevent Dugan from getting the documents. Retired nurse Charlene Bailey says everything changed in 1973.
Roe versus Wade passed, and the patients that were sick that came into that emergency room stopped. It just stopped.
Pittsburgh, having this small group, very forward-looking people, they were ready.
Claire Keyes ran Allegheny Reproductive Health Center for 30 years. She says activists quickly opened women's health services, the first clinic in Pittsburgh that provided abortions, after the Supreme Court ruling.
They had the building. The lease was signed in anticipation of the decision. They had the list of all the supplies that would be needed. And just a few months later, Women's Health Services opened their doors and started doing abortions.
Dr. Thompson was also associate medical director at Women's Health in addition to his work at McGee. He estimated that the clinic did around 11,000 abortions per year when he worked there. Pittsburgh became one of the biggest abortion providers in the state, and Pennsylvania was one of the top providers in the country in the years after Roe.
That doesn't mean that there wasn't anybody who was opposed to it. Certainly there were people, but they just weren't as organized.
Claire Keyes says clinics didn't get a lot of pushback when they opened, at least not at first.
And I can't tell you when anything started at our clinic, but I can tell you that we were specifically the base station for the original training films for protests of a larger sort. And that's when we were having 600 to 800 protesters per clinic day appearing from all sorts of other states, and they would block the doors. I mean, but that's another story in and of itself.
A very different narrative would dominate the abortion rights conversation in Pittsburgh in the 1980s. I'm Lucy Perkins, 90.5 WESA News.
Our series on the history of abortion in Pennsylvania continues tomorrow with the story of how anti-abortion rights protesters in Pittsburgh helped spawn a national movement. It's The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh has a rich jazz history that dates back a century, but ensuring that young artists continue to add to that history and that jazz is economically viable in Pittsburgh is the work of the Pittsburgh Jazz Hub. Joining us in studio today are Harry Clark, founder of the Creative and Performing Arts High School, CAPA. Welcome, Harry. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, Kevin.
Drummer Tom Wendt, who is one of the two leaders, along with Harry, of the Pittsburgh Jazz Hub. Tom, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us.
And also, longtime jazz host Bob Studebaker, operations manager for JazzWorks, a 24/7 music service heard across the country. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
All right. So I said Pittsburgh Jazz Hub. It was a pilot project, I believe three other cities plus Pittsburgh. How did that come about? What was its purpose? Tom, we'll start with you and others. Please chime in.
Well, the project was sort of the invention of a group that was based on the West Coast called the Jazz Forward Coalition that was headed up by a gentleman by the name of Peter Gordon. And their whole concept was to choose four pilot or hub cities in America and to sort of come up with a custom way for each city to have their jazz community, what they call the jazz ecosystem, which is just a fancy word for a jazz community or a jazz scene, to help each city's jazz community work together more efficiently. In any arts community, you know, you have all of these different individual entities that are all sort of, you know, out there paddling away in their own little rowboats against the same tide. And when, you know, a community, any arts community can work better together, it can definitely make things easier for everyone. So,
absolutely. And I think the important thing here is when this started out, we talked about the word trust, getting an opportunity for everybody to be able to say, look, we're in this thing together. And we needed to work together. And before that, we had to work hard to develop that sense of trust.
And also just getting people to understand that this is going to work for everybody as well. It's for years, for decades, I've done different things to try to collate different jazz events and have a central place in different contexts for people to have as a reference source. And it's not always easy to get that. It's not easy to get musicians to buy into it, to regularly let you know when a gig is happening, and even harder than that is when a gig is over and it's not happening anymore, because sometimes there'll be a 3 or 4 weeks to stay at a particular place. Sometimes it'll go on for months. But when it's over, you don't want to still be saying, hey, go see so-and-so at such and such place when he hasn't been there for 2 weeks. Then you lose the trust of the people who count on you as a reference source. It can be a little bit like herding cats, but it's
can be very much like herding.
Yeah, but it has been established now with, and Tom, you can talk at greater length about this, Jazz sure. Near You. Jazz Near Pittsburgh is a website where people can go to and they can find the sometimes 50, 60 jazz events in a week are happening around town if you count private events where not necessarily open to the public, but there is a lot of jazz happening. Mm-hmm. Anytime somebody is having an upscale event that you want to be accessible at the same time, but you want to have a certain elegance, but still have it casual and comfortable. Jazz is the music of choice. Jazz is incomparably elegant, but it's also very earthy, and it works well for background music or as a focus.
I wanted to mention that in addition to Pittsburgh, it was Phoenix, Portland, Oregon, and Washington, D.C. Any idea why those other three were chosen? And the second part of the question is, did you all do your own work as part of this pilot project, or did you keep in touch with the teams in other cities?
Well, I think the cities that were chosen because they were looking for a real sort of cross-section of American cities. You have Phoenix that has a very good jazz scene now, but doesn't have a whole lot in the way of jazz history. Portland, which is a very progressive city and has a great music scene, not, you know, specifically known as a jazz city, but they, you know, they're very progressive and they have a lot of great music there. And then you have cities like Pittsburgh and Washington, which have very storied histories in jazz, especially Pittsburgh.
Washington being Duke Ellington's hometown, among others.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that's the reason that those cities were chosen. And yes, we have been in contact with the other cities. They've all been doing quite well. And they're all working. We're all working very much on our own. That was sort of one of the hallmarks of the plan, was that each city was going to address needs specific to that city. There wasn't sort of like a cookie cutter plan for each city, which is, I think, for me, that's kind of what was a big attraction to
it. And I thought it was kind of interesting too when we had the opportunity to call in a phone conference,
right,
where all the cities were represented, and we're able to kind of measure the kinds of things that we were attempting to do and say, well, you have that same problem we have. How are you addressing that? So there was some exchange there, but as Tom had indicated, we pretty much needed to do our individual thing.
Yeah, what we kind of found after we started working together was that all four cities had very similar problems, but they also had unique problems within that. So it was really interesting to hear what Portland was dealing with or what D.C. was dealing with, because there inevitably would be similarities but differences all the same. So it was a very interesting process in that regard to kind of see what other cities were dealing with in terms of challenges.
Could you borrow some of the solutions?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we did. And basically, just to give you a little bit more history on it, last year we had two what they called summit meetings, one in June and then one in November here in Pittsburgh, and they were both very successful. For me personally, as a musician, it was really incredible to be in a room and look around and see people who I never thought would be in the same room together. Talking, yeah. That's a wonderful thing. And that's something that in the arts community doesn't happen nearly enough. The communication is just not what it should be.
Yeah, sometimes you find people working essentially at the same thing, but in their own way, and they have their own turf. And to get people to realize that working cooperatively with somebody else, it doesn't always come naturally. It can feel as if, well, I'm a competitor. And to a certain extent, there is competition, but this isn't the 1930s where musicians are getting up on the bandstand trying to blow each other off the stage by their prowess on their instrument. There is a collegiality. There really is. There's a collegiality among musicians, not just within jazz, but I think within the broader music community and the broader arts community, a recognition that, hey, we are all creating art in our own way, following our own muse, and we have there are many points of commonality, and we work better together.
And I thought it was kind of interesting to watch too. I mentioned the word trust, because I saw that happening. Once there was a feeling of, I can express myself, and some of my points and some of my ideas are being listened to, and I thought that once there was that sense of, we are in this thing together, you could see that there was an opportunity for everybody to say, I can put my information on the table, and we can discuss.
Yeah, it's a very, very important thing, because I think, as Bob mentioned, we are the landscape of our culture today is making it important for people to work together, because the whole divide and conquer thing is just not going to work. It's very difficult out here to do this. And so the more camaraderie and the more working together that can happen, it's just going to make it better for everybody. And to see that sort of sink in and people realize that is a very good thing.
The names of Pittsburgh jazz artists make up really a who's who, from Ray Brown to Art Blakey to Earl Garner, to Earl Father Hines, to Mary Lou Williams, to Billy Strayhorn, to Billy Eckstein, George Benson. I could go on, and I'll stop.
You didn't mention Harry Clark.
I did mention Harry Clark, because he's sitting right across from me. But to each of you, with that rich history, that tapestry of performers, is it sad that we even need a jazz hub to establish an economic ecosystem to foster the local jazz community? I mean, shouldn't that just be enough momentum in that heritage, that history, just to just keeps flourishing?
Well, I think any community from time to time needs, a bit of a kick in the behind, because it's we're in a very difficult time right now as far as, the arts, funding for the arts in general. And I think, you know, it can wear on people, you know, and I think from time to time you do need a little bit of a kickstart. So I don't think it's a bad thing personally.
No, I totally agree. I can remember when I could not have a person playing an electronic bass in my group. I mean, there's change, okay, and change does happen. I thought it's very, very healthy. And the opportunity to communicate with each other is important.
And choices for entertainment dollars are so broad nowadays. Mm-hmm. 30, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, jazz clubs, which were everywhere, all through the Hill, through East Liberty, they were in many places around town, they didn't have the competition. You didn't have as much to sit and watch at home, where Netflix and Amazon brings you first-run movies. So ultimately, I think from going forward, and it's been that way for a while, jazz will exist in a way somehow very much like classical music exists. It'll be fostered in universities and educational institutions like Kappa and private homes, as it always has. It'll always live, you know, it comes to life in people's homes where their children hear it first and go on out to further the mission of the music or the playing of the music. But also it's going to take foundation support, concerted efforts on behalf of the people who are devotees of the music. And
you mentioned universities, Bob, and that was such an important thing with Dr. Nathan Davis and his role.
And John Wilson.
John Wilson at Duquesne and Nathan Davis at Pitt.
And Nathan Davis, I told you this the other day, he was in Paris in the 1960s, and it was Dizzy Gillespie who told him, we're going to start seeing universities in America put jazz programs together. And as Dizzy said to Dr. Davis, we need to run these, meaning we, African-American musicians, and what we need to do is have people get PhDs. And that's why Dr. Davis became Dr. Davis. He got his PhD so that he could run the program, which he did so magnificently for years. What he brought to town is incomparable.
I think that's a great point, and it plays into the group that we have now, because out of these two summit meetings came sort of a task force. We asked for volunteers, and we have a group of about 14 people who have been working together over the last year. And it's a great group, because it's sort of a wonderful cross-section of the Pittsburgh jazz community. We have musicians, jazz educators, jazz presenters, jazz promoters, jazz radio hosts. It's a wonderful group of people who are working together.
So we have just a couple of minutes left.
Sure.
I want to ask you about the importance of partnerships with other organizations helping each other, whether it's the City of Asylum or something else. How important is that to the vitality of jazz? We'll start with you, Harry.
Yeah, it's extremely important. It's important for one organization to be able to say to the overall community that there's something happening with another organization. That supportive effort that is extremely important for communication, for people to understand, hey, there's something else going on. And I found it out at Venue A. Venue A is talking about Venue B. And I think that it's extremely important. Communication.
Yeah. We just last month, our first sort of project as a group was an event, a 10-day event that we called the Pittsburgh Jazz Days of Summer, which was basically just a celebration of all jazz events happening in Pittsburgh during that time, which there were over 50. And it was sort of everybody coming together as a united front. I mean, all the presenters, all of the promoters were involved, and it was a wonderful thing to see everybody sort of come together and promote Pittsburgh jazz as sort of a united front together.
Branded as Pittsburgh Jazz Days of Summer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In our remaining minute, I want you to each give me a brief reason of why. I mean, you gentlemen are obviously confident about the future of jazz in this community. Why should we be confident? Is it the talent that's there, the awareness, the dedication? What is it?
The music itself continues to reinvent itself, because jazz, unlike other art forms, wants to have new influences come in and change it and mutate it and evolve it. And it looks for catalysts to move it into new directions. And that is just part and parcel of what jazz is. So it is continually being revitalized.
20 seconds, Tom.
I travel quite a bit as a musician, and I'm in a lot of other cities. And one thing that makes Pittsburgh beautifully unique is that, as far as the jazz community goes, all of the pieces are here. We just have to put them together, and we're starting to do that.
And you get the last 15, Eric.
I get the last 15. I remember something in Roger Humphrey's Pass It On. Pass It On. Mm-hmm. And he had a lot. He has a lot to pass on to our younger people. And it so it's alive, and it's well. Jazz.
Harry Clark is founder of the Creative and Performing Arts High School, Pittsburgh Public Schools. Drummer Tom Wendt, two of the leaders of the Pittsburgh Jazz Hub, and Bob Studebaker, operations manager for WESA's Jazz Works, a 24/7 music service heard across the country. Thanks to all of you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, Scott Gormley, director of the documentary film Danseur. The film chronicles the widespread abuse and bullying boys and young men face as ballet dancers. Also, part three in our abortion series, how the anti-abortion protest movement in Pittsburgh became a national model. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.